And our special guest, John Hogue, we're going to talk about end times. Is this the last pope? And we'll take your calls as well on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, John Hogue with us here. John, let's talk a little bit about prophecy. You are one of the only people, experts, prophecy experts, to kind of push away the prophecies of St. Malachi and his thoughts on the last pope. Tell us more.
Yes, the medieval Irish saint Malachi is purported to have written 111 or mottos, Latin mottos, that have about 11 possible clues. Sometimes one or more are in them, but there's up to 11 possible ways that you can decipher them. And they were written around 1140, and the story goes that they were in the archives of Rome and were rediscovered in the mid-1590s and sandwiched into a book on Benedictine history of the Benedictine order, even though Malachi was a Celestine monk. And Dom Arnold Weon wrote this huge, massive book, which few of us remember the rest of the book, except for the two pages inserted about these list of mottos, Latin prophecies attributed to St. Malachi, with a coda, a paragraph for the final 112th pope, which is supposed to be the last pope. The thing that got me suspicious when looking at this, when I wrote my first in the English language, first complete, large, full-bodied examination of the Malachi prophecies, the last pope, which I published in 1998, I noticed that the first 76 quotes before they were quote-unquote rediscovered are almost perfectly fitting one of any number of the 11 possible ways to decipher it. And that, as a prophecy scholar, always gets me a little suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing is perfect in prophecy because unlike what a lot of people think, that everything's already happened and divinely planned.
Etched in stone, right?
Yeah, and I bear witness after 30 years of this to that being completely erroneous. The only thing, and I strive in my 33 books in 20 languages to explain why that's erroneous, and how it only appears that things are written in stone because so much of what makes us makes prophecy so interesting is the way people are conditioned to be very robotic and predictable by their society.
Mm-hmm.
And that real genius, if it ever overtakes this planet, will be the end of prophecy because no one will really be able to predict what comes next because intelligence is not very, very predictable. It's not mediocre. When looking at that, I thought that was very suspicious. So then the important thing to do is look at the last 36 pontiffs, the mottos for the last 36 that would happen after its publication in 1595 or so. And usually what happens in these kind of affairs where somebody is hiding behind the name of a prophet, you'll see it even in the Nostradamus field. There were some writers who wrote books where they said, we have decoded Nostradamus, we found the green language, we found this or that, and we've unraveled all of his strange obscurities. You'll always notice that they make a nice run for about 18 months of predictions that usually gives their book a nice little profit run before the events actually happen, and usually they're even worse than chance odds. It's like below 50%. That should have happened with these prophecies if there was some mystery man writing under the name of St. Malachi.
Ah, okay.
But it didn't. In fact, and in this new book I released, I actually had the inspiration to slap it together in the week that Pope Francis was here in the United States. I actually released it on the final day that he was in Philadelphia, and it's called Francis and the Last Pope Prophecies of St. Malachi, and it's available at Amazon.com. Just type in the search engine, Hogue, my name, and it'll prompt up with all my other current books.
Good.
And So I looked at that and I said, well, okay, let's look at step by step the 36 of them. And it's amazing to see, George, how many are accurate. I would say that the accuracy is arguably in the upper 80 percentile.
That's
which
huge.
Makes
That's
this one of the most accurate sets of prophecies tested by events that I've ever come across in my 30 plus years doing this. So whoever this person was an authentic seer and was probably hiding and protecting themselves by doing what is an ancient tradition in prophecy, writing under the name of some august and respected prophet. There, for instance, the Bible scholars will tell you that there are three distinct styles in the book of Isaiah, which show that there must be three different people using the name Isaiah in the book of Isaiah. The same with Zechariah, there's two distinct forms in that, and on it goes. So, but in our day, we think of that as some kind of charlatan act, but in ancient times, that was considered an honor, a perpetuating of some great noble seer to write under his name. So I think this person was doing the same, protecting themselves from the Inquisition,
right,
and at the same time making a serious prophetic splash and not needing the ego stroking to actually use their name.
If Pope Francis is indeed the last pope, what does that mean?
Well, it's two possible things. Because there's a break in the style, each up until 111 of these have been two or three word phrases, like in the case of John Paul II, De Labora Solis, which in medieval Latin means the sun's labor in an eclipse. And he was born on an eclipse, and he was interned under the base into the he was buried in St. Peter's Basilica on the day of an eclipse. So that's what that means. Benedict was called the Gloria Olivae, from the glory of the olive. And since Benedictines had been foreseeing a Benedict or a Benedictine Pope as some Pope towards the end of the reign of popes, it's not quite what happened. Benedict is not a Benedictine, although he loved Saint Benedict and also his predecessor Benedict the 15th, and so he used the name Benedict. But interestingly enough, the motto Gloria Olivae, the glory of the olive, is probably an allusion to the Mount of Olives prophecy, which looks essentially, it's the closest thing we have to a true witnessed utterance of prophecy coming from the mouth of Jesus, because in the case of the book of Revelation, St. John is actually talking to an angel who's the go-between between Christ and himself. This is when they were all sitting around Jesus after he made a statement about how the temple could be taken down and resurrected in 3 days. And they went up to the Mount of Olives outside of Jerusalem to have him explain himself. And that's where the little apocalypse was uttered by Jesus. And it's in the New Testament and Matthew and Luke and Mark in slightly different forms. But basically, it's about apostasy. It's about a crisis in faith. And in the Catholic apocalyptic view of apocalyptic prophecy, it's more focused on a crisis in the church at the very highest point, where the Pope has lost his faith or lost his way, and his cardinals. So a lot of people are anticipating that Gloria Olivae is somewhat of a subsection of the Benedictines, the Olivetans, which were in charged with interpreting the little apocalypse of Jesus, the apostasy, being the warners and the messengers of that. A lot of Catholic interpreters of prophecy thought, well, this probably means that whoever this person is, there's going to be great crisis that's going to undermine the very roots of the leadership of the faith. And Benedict's rule has seen one of the most significant scandals of the Catholic Church's many scandals over the years, dealing with pedophiles, which Ratzinger, when he was cardinal, was the main agent of suppressing under the long rule of John Paul II. And he continued to suppress it as pope until it exploded out because of his butler revealing a lot of this information to the Roman press.
Couldn't hide it anymore.
So this created this is what brought Francis into power, because I can tell you from my sources in the Vatican, it was a year before I was writing about it, a year before it happened, I was saying he's probably going to have to either go feet first or resign or retire. And he did. He retired. But really, he was fired. But they made it look...
Good point.
Yeah. And then you had a revolutionary pope take over. And he takes on the name of Francis, St. Francis of Assisi.
He seems to be doing everything right, John.
Well, he's certainly, he seems to have the elements. It's almost as if he's a marriage of two very reform-minded modern popes, John the 23rd, who created the Vatican II, and John Paul I, Cardinal Luciani, who only lasted a month and then died of rather suspicious circumstances. Some believe he was poisoned, because he was actually going to expose the Vatican Bank for all the mafia money laundering that actually was still going on. Francis also discovered that even though John Paul II said all this was fixed, it actually was discovered that the laundering had not ceased since all that happened in 1978. So this pope is actually fixing it. But I feel that he's a combination of those two popes, the smiling pope and John the 23rd. I think he's freaking out a lot of the more traditional triumphalist Catholics in the church. And one will wonder if they're biding their time to make a move on him, but he's just too popular and too beloved. And he's, to answer your question earlier about
is he the last pope,
there are two ways that can be looked at. He most likely is. But then again, there's the idea of he's the only pope mentioned that's not just a phrase, but an entire paragraph. And his name is Petrus Romanus, Peter of Rome. Now, first, your listeners got to know that there's an unwritten rule in Catholic protocol that no one will ever be named Pope Peter outright. But that doesn't mean that they can't be, and their birth name can't be Pietro or Peter, because that's one of the 11 clues. A lot of the mottos are describing the names that they were born with or the names they took up when they became pope. Now, in the case of Jorge Bergoglio, he has no Peter in his name, the Argentinian cardinal who became Francis. However, St. Francis, in his long, full official Christian name, has Pietro in it. Also, Francisco is like Frenchie, to be translated bluntly, is kind of, well, actually it doesn't really connect it does actually connect with some of Nostradamus's quatrains, actually, that talk about a pope coming from ancient France. And one of the most ancient parts of France is where St. Francis's father used to do business, and Francis used to come along with him when he was a child, and that is Provence, the native land of Nostradamus, which was a kingdom on its own until it became part of the French reign, the French provinces. But the book goes into all of that. And so Peter is in the name of the Christian name of St. Francis. So there is a link there. And there are other links, too, which point to it. But it could also mean that because the apostasy started with Benedict, it could also be just a jump to the last pope. Now that the sequence of mottos has been broken, the pattern has been broken, one could also surmise that maybe there are dozens more popes before the final days, and this Petrus Romanus is actually, they just jumped to the end of the list.
And what's fascinating here, too, that even though it may create some upheaval as the last pope for the church, it doesn't necessarily mean that end times does us all in, right?
Well, because in all end time traditions around the world, the problem always is that the all of us, whatever the faith or religion that we're in that has eschatological prophecies, end time prophecies involved, we're on this side of the door, trying our best to listen through the door or look through the cracks in the door to see what's actually on the other side, what the revelation, the apocalypse is, because apocalypse in Greek means lifting the veil, you know, seeing the light. And so when we're darkened on this side, at best we can use our intuition, our prophetic gifts to kind of get some idea of something that's probably beyond our understanding, as much as if we were all a bunch of people who can only see black and white, can't probably understand the concept of technicolor. And so there is a very interesting near contemporary of St. Malachi, which I also talk about in the book, who's Joachim di Fiore, who was a Calabrian priest that lived a little later after St. Malachi, who had written a very intriguing theory that the evolution of God's work on earth happened according to the Trinity, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, that each of these is an era lasting 20 centuries. The first was the Father, you know, the Old Testament, God, Jehovah, the Father, followed by 20 centuries of the Son, the era of Jesus. It is now, after 2,000 years, that we are now in the cusp point, the borderline between the Jesus era and the era of the Holy Spirit. Joachim di Fiore was very clever in how he wrote about this without getting himself in trouble with Inquisition. He basically kind of made it sound to anyone who had a certain bias towards it that the church would be, that God would be on earth and everything would be fine, and people could fill in the assumption that that means that the church is restored and everything is fine and our form of Christianity is dominating all over the world, because it's a very common habit of all traditions. They always feel like the Jews believe everybody will be converted to Judaism, the Muslims in their apocalyptic prophecies believe all the Jews will be converted to Islam and everybody else, and on it goes. But actually, it could mean that there's no religions, that God's spirit is
That
direct.
Would be interesting. John, you've been working on something for Halloween. We're going to talk about that, and we're going to take promised calls next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with our guest, John Hoag. Let's take some calls here, and then we're going to talk about what he's working on for Halloween. Get ready for that. Carl in Rochester, New York, welcome to the program. Carl, go ahead.
Hello. Yeah, I was wondering, that asteroid they just discovered 2 weeks ago, the size of Mount Everest.
Yes.
Is that a part of end times?
Well,
no,
I don't think so. Go ahead, John.
No, I don't think it's there's actually an asteroid that is more intriguing towards that line of thinking called Apophis, that I think does, I can't quite remember this hour, what the late 2020s it's supposed to make.
I think 2036 is the real close pass.
Yeah, and that's the one that could be altered by the first pass, altering its
that's
orbit.
Right.
And what's intriguing about it is the volume and the size is almost exactly the volume and size of a number of Nostradamus quatrains that talk about basically a mountain a quarter mile in circumference falling out of the sky and hitting the Aegean Sea and causing a splash that actually oversplashes Mount Olympus. It's about 10,000 foot splash. And then other prophecies talking about the great antiquities being taken down by huge tidal waves, seven that hit Monaco. And when you consider what would happen if a asteroid that size hit the Aegean Sea, it would cause quite a lot of tidal waves, a tsunami
of biblical
one of them mounts
proportions.
Right up to Fesulun, which is the old name for Frisia, which is a little mountain medieval town perched above Firenze or Florence in Tuscany. And so that would mean that the wave would go all the way up the Arno Valley to the foot of that perched fortress medieval town, which would be almost 1,000 feet.
1,000 feet would wipe out inland 50, 60 miles.
Yeah, so it's a... it doesn't say what date, but so I always look at these things and look at the... But it does say what size this mountain coming out of the sky is. There's about three quatrains, four-line verses of Nostradamus that seem to be related to that subject. So I keep my eyes out for this one. But this one that was recently found, I don't think it's going to do anything.
Let's go to Wolf Point, Montana. On the wild card line, we've got Mike with us. Michael, go ahead.
Hey, George, John.
Hey, Mike.
I just have one quick question. I was wondering, John, what do you think of a Trump-Carson ticket with Jesse Ventura as Secretary of State?
Good old Jesse. I don't know if Jesse would take that, but what do you think of that kind of a ticket, Trump-Carson?
Well, you know, Jesse Ventura is a good friend of Donald. They're golfing buddies.
Yeah.
I came across an interesting thing on YouTube where they were talking not long ago, and it's one of the times where Donald Trump really showed a softness and a warmth. He really loves his friend, and one of the interesting surprises that I find the more I get into Trump's writings and his astrology. And he definitely listens to Ventura about how to manage this potential presidency, because Trump is doing what anyone who's a maverick can only do, whether you're Bernie Sanders, who's a socialist, or you're Trump, who's an independent capitalist, your own corporate person going against the corporate oligarchy.
Yeah.
You cannot, as Ron Paul famously said, you cannot be even seen as a viable candidate unless you put on the mantle Republican or Democrat, because it's a rigged system. And I mean, he never was a Republican, he's always a libertarian, but he said, you know, this is the rules of the game. It's if you're not part of the Crips, the Democrips, or the Republic Bloodlickens, you know, you're not going to, you're
you
not in the hood.
Yep.
You got to wear the blue bandana or the red bandana. And so I've never considered Trump, and I'm surprised how he's able to sneak by things in these debates. And because he's done the thing, he's gripped the heart, the collective heart of a lot of the hardcore right of center Republican voters that you must have to win any primary. But it's amazing how he's able to artfully talk about universal health care and say to Jeb Bush's face that your brother did a terrible job in Iraq. You know, it's like it's these kind of speaking truth, even if it's somewhat blunt and maybe not as nice as he could say it. But the fact that he's speaking truth is just upset the status quo and turned on a whole lot of people who kind of felt these things, wanted to say these things. The same with Bernie Sanders, the same with Ben Carson. They're generating a lot of that, but I don't think Ben Carson would be on the ticket.
People are fed up, John, and I think that's one of the reasons why someone like Donald Trump is doing so well.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if, I mean, Donald Trump, whoever he'd pick, would be a surprise. Maybe it'd even be Ron Paul. I don't know.
I think he should pick Condoleezza Rice. What do you think?
It's
a smart pick.
It's hard just for simple political reasons. It's Bush fatigue. It's just like it's something that actually Hillary Clinton is going to have to do. Like I was saying, as a karmic echo to Nixon, she's going to also have to make the new Hillary, just like Nixon had to come out in 67, 68 as the new Nixon before he ran in 68. And she's in the process of doing that. She has to, but I think the problem, too, is that there's just still too much Bush fatigue.
Nah, she was just taking marching orders, but
you know, the problem with politics, George, is it has nothing to do with truth. It has to do with perception.
Yep.
Perception is truth in politics, and it's unfair to Condoleezza Rice, but it's just the reality of politics. And the other thing too is the perception is people are sick and tired of establishment politics. So it really is a chance for somebody like Trump to actually win early and win big and go all the way to the convention for nomination. Although I also look at the scenario of him having what he would do in a brokered convention. And my sense is that he would probably use that leverage again and say, hey, the system's broken. I don't feel obligated to honor this thing I signed from the head of the RNC.
Mm-hmm.
And so he'd kind of use that as a leverage to say, I'll take all my angry people with me. And maybe if you vote me in, then that's not a shoe-in for Hillary winning. That could be what he'd be saying behind the closed doors or intimating. So I don't think that leverage is gone yet. I mean, he made it very clear, everything will be fine if I'm treated fairly. One of the strongest things about Trump's personality is he doesn't mind being hit hard, but he really has a button about lies, what he perceives as lies.
What he perceives,
that's right. And then people are just being unfair. And that's expressed in a lot of afflicted squares that he has with his ruling planet, Mercury, as a Gemini. But he has, unlike the last two presidents, he has so many counterbalancing, very amazingly good, lucky, and positive trines and harmonious aspects that I've rarely seen in any study of anybody give him a lot more tools to counterbalance the bad with the good. The other thing that's nice is that his astrology is very harmonious with the Russian president. So I think whatever he's done business in Russia, I think he gets the Russians more than most Americans do. And the Chinese, who have one of their major banks in Trump Tower, which kind of is, again, what's unique about him is even the outrageous things he says, he actually backs it up with, if you look at it, he says, well, yeah, he really did that. Yeah, the Chinese really do respect him, because no Chinese major bank would go be in Trump's tower if Beijing and the government, which runs the bank,
didn't respect him. Exactly.
And so I also know from my sources in Moscow that a lot of people in Moscow are hoping that they'll have a guy like Trump to deal with, because they'll know where they stand.
I wonder who he'd surround himself with in terms of cabinet members.
Well, I think he'd run it. In the chapter about his presidency, I would imagine, a lot of this material, surprisingly enough, is out there in The Art of the Deal, which I've read, and mm-hmm. in some of his books looking at how to make America great again and all of that. He's very detailed about a lot of these ideas. Much more than any other candidate that's out there. It's funny how the media has really dropped the ball on that. They should be looking at his book, quoting his book, asking him if he still thinks A, B, and C, and D is really
right.
what he wants
Holds
to do.
Up.
Yeah, so there's a lot more going on there than, I just got an email from somebody who was saying, oh, I can't stand Trump because his son went and shot an elephant in a hunt. And again, that gets back to the problem. It's like, oh, I'll never listen to Wagner's music because he said nasty things about the Jews. These are true. These things happen. But I would just say to all of you, be mindful of not letting one character flaw make you blind to the rest. Because this person might be your president. And it might be good to understand the bigger picture of a more complicated man like Donald Trump is.
Boy, it sounds like you're making predictions already, John, but I'm not going to hold you to it yet.
Yeah, not yet, but I mean, part of this unorthodox year that's coming, I've made quite a shift with this.
You have. This is dramatic for you.
This may be my first loss.
We'll see. Let's go to Portland, Oregon. Russ has turned west of the Rockies. Russ, you're on with John Hogue. Go ahead.
Yeah, good evening, George and John.
Hi, Russ.
Hi.
I think I heard John say that the greatest days of America are past, but I feel that Donald Trump is going to make America great again, because he's going to use that Reagan-style economics, where he's going to cut corporate taxes and bring jobs back to America, and I think that's the way to go.
Well, the thing is, he is, again, another karmic echo. He is the karmic echo of Ronald Reagan. In one of the chapters in the book, I show how a lot of what was said to Reagan in the early stages was exactly what they're saying to Trump. He's too abrasive. He's not really a professional politician. He's too abrasive. He's too spontaneous with what he says. He'll upset too many groups. Reagan, it's kind of ironic that they had the debates in Ronald Reagan's presidential library, because he was the ultimate outsider. I mean, he also, like Trump, started as a Democrat. A lot of the Republicans said he wasn't a true Republican, just like they're saying to Trump. And so there's a karmic lesson returned in Donald Trump if he's president. He'll go through the processes, the nation will go with him as a leader through the processes of things we needed to learn with Reagan and didn't. And one of the things is that Donald Trump might actually be, I kind of jokingly in earnest in the final chapter say that he's probably, Donald Trump would make a better emperor than a president. But if he were that kind of a imperial president, he would be like Diocletian, who was the Roman emperor who reformed Rome and gave it an extra 100 years of life, because he completely restructured the system. And so I kind of look at Trump in that regard, that he might rebuild, renovate America in ways that even surprise me, because I also have to get past my own all-too-human desire of looking at one thing and going, I don't think I want that person there.
Exactly.
But I have to look beyond that. And I'm asking all of my readers and listeners to also, with all these candidates, expand your vision to look at the whole picture, because we will all be deciding with our vote who's going to be the next president. And that goes for Hillary Clinton as well as for Donald Trump.
You predicted Barack Obama. Are you disappointed with his presidency?
Well, I said a year before he was president that if he ran in 2008 and stole the election because of the Hillary Clinton's issues, which I mentioned earlier, would be her albatross politically, and he would win in 2008, that he'd come to power too soon and not prepared for the job. And I unfortunately have to say that he has fulfilled that. And although I also noticed that he had the best chance of creating peace in the Middle East with Iran, and it looks like that aspect may still have some legs. But unfortunately, the first two presidents of the 21st century have something in astrology that you never want in a president. It's the sun squared Neptune. It means his perception, his ego is not in sync with his subconscious, his hidden enemies. God will talk to him and tell him to invade Iraq, and it's completely his mind telling him that.
That's dangerous.
Both Bush and Obama have that sign in their charts. But what's intriguing to me is Donald Trump doesn't have that. But his relationship, if you do a chart of what his relationship to Lady Liberty would be as president, it comes up in the relationship of Trump as president with the United States, the same square, which is better to have it that way than to be your own perceptor being warped. It means that he'd probably have a pretty rocky, challenging marriage with the United States. And the question I can't really answer yet at this point is it because the country just can't keep up with Trump, or Trump just can't do the job because, mm-hmm. again, he's been the outsider dealing with politics. Now he's the ultimate insider.
Let's go to David in Fairbanks, Alaska. Squeeze you in here, Dave. Go ahead.
Yes. Good evening. I was listening, John, to your comments. I really, really am enjoying this show. And you were talking about the Catholic Church and the prophecies and so forth. I just wanted to give a suggestion that that you look into that you look into the history of the Catholic Church. I know that there's controversy with Benedict and Francis and so forth. And Francis, I'm a huge fan of. But I think the prophecy issue within the church began directly with the Second Vatican Council. And there are a large group of Catholics in the church today. I am a proud Vatican II Catholic. I'm fairly progressive. But I know a large amount of what we would call sede vacantis Catholics, who are also a very large group, even in the United States. And they believe that since Vatican II, since Pope Paul VI, debatable with Pope John XXIII, that because of the Vatican Council, Second Vatican Council, that they have in fact lost their faith.
That's very possible. Yes, John, we've got 30 seconds left. What are you doing for Halloween?
Well, I'm going to try to publish a book called Everything You Always Wanted to Know About 666, But We're Afraid to Ask.
You got a week to get it out there.
Oh, it'll be out. It's a book mixed with fun, and we're laughing at 666 as much as being informative.
Where do we find it? Amazon?
Yeah, it'll be on Amazon, but if you want to get a personal message when it's out, just go to my contact button and write on the subject line 666.
You got it. John Hogue, thank you so much. Always, you'll have you back on. Up next, we're going to talk about machines that actually learn. Oh, boy, what does that mean to us?